So Donald Trump tried tariffs and he wants to try them again. Should American workers cheer about that? And of course, California Democrats also want to help workers. They're doing it by raising the minimum wage for fast food establishments. How's that going to work out? And have the enemies of big government found a new ally in RFK Jr.? We're going to talk about these things and more on Independent Outlook. Welcome, everybody. My name is Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. We try and bring you in this program an independent take on the issues of the day. And I am delighted to be joined in this effort today by my two colleagues. Let me begin with Williamson Evers. Dr. Williamson Evers is the director of our Center on Educational Excellence. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Thank you, Graham.
And also by my other colleague, Philip Magnus, who is the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy and a senior fellow here at Independent Institute. Welcome, Phil.
Happy to be here.
It's great to talk with both of you, and I think we have a lot of great friends who tune into our program and want to get the latest on what we think about some of these things. In particular, let's start with this question about tariffs. So former President Donald Trump, now candidate, has been talking up tariffs. In his previous run in 2016, he talked up tariffs. He was going to defend the American worker. He raised tariffs, which was really the first experiment in tariff raising in the U.S. on any scale for quite a while. How did that work out, Phil? And what should we think about Donald Trump's advocacy of tariffs to protect the American worker?
Well, his track record is not so great. As you mentioned, Donald Trump's first term was the first major turn toward raising tariffs and engaging in protectionism more broadly since 1930. So quite a bit of time since we've had an overt protectionist in office. And he's running again on trying to revive that record. But during his first term, his stated goal was to reverse the trade imbalance of the United States, which is kind of like this statistical relic of accounting of goods that cross borders. And any economist will look at this and tell you basically it's an illusory measure of asserting that you want more exports than imports. Well, something has to pay for those exports, so something else is coming back in. And it's basically only like looking at half of your accounting sheet when you try to target policies.
And it doesn't, things like financial services and so forth are not going to be reflected.
Exactly. I mean, money has to pay for goods that are purchased. So it's like only looking at half the balance sheet. And Trump stated that it was his objective to reverse the trade imbalance and make exports exceed imports. And he failed basically at this, didn't accomplish anything. You're quite the opposite, that the supposed trade imbalance basically goes the other direction. He also claimed that he was doing these tariff measures to supposedly save or revitalize American manufacturing, and the data simply doesn't seem to be there. Quite the opposite of it. It turns out that like all of his stated policy goals and objectives for putting tariffs in the first place were not met, and in fact end up being based on economic fallacy. So here he's coming back campaigning for a second term. Where I'm really concerned about this, though, is during the first term, even though Trump was a protectionist, and even though Trump had certain advisors that were saying, yes, we need tariffs on everything, he was counterbalanced by some of the more free market voices on the Council of Economic Advisers that were involved in the administration. Unfortunately, right now, Trump is signaling his second term that his primary economic advisors are going to be, quite frankly, I'll call them economic crackpots. These are people that are throwbacks to 19th century protectionist theory, like Robert Lighthizer, Orrin Cass, some of these characters that are claiming they revived and rediscovered this lost tradition from the 18th and 19th century of how to do economic policy. And I look at this, I kind of liken it to, this would be like the medical profession appointing an advisor who still subscribe to leeches as the way to deal with diseases, leeches and bloodletting. These theories were discarded for good reason because they were discredited.
They were lost theories and they should stay lost, except the historian.
Exactly.
Well, now, what if someone responds to you, though, and says, Phil, well, yeah, maybe it wasn't all great, but at least it reinforced and got us a bunch of new manufacturing jobs in Youngstown, Ohio, and similar places. Is that true?
Well, there's the classic seen versus unseen phenomenon that happens in all of these tariff situations and protectionism in general. I mean, the policy is always, well, we're going to get new jobs in this one very specific industry. We'll say the steel industry. Steel has been seeking protectionism basically since 1789 to yesterday. It's the great theme of American history. And the idea here is, you know, we put tariffs on steel, we prop it up. There's two effects that are happening here. First, we ask the question, does it actually work? Does it save the steel industry? I'd urge anyone who thinks that the tariffs have saved the steel industry to look at what's going on in the steel industry in the United States right now. The major companies that invested all of their energies into the politics of attaining tariffs still faltered. U.S. Steel is basically went for sale to foreign investors. Before that, Bethlehem Steel was the major giant in the early 2000s, and it faltered as well after investing all of its efforts in securing tariffs. So one, they don't work. But the second effect is the supposed really concentrated benefit that comes back to the protected industry in steel also comes at the expense of 330 million consumers nationwide. It means that I have to pay a little bit more for my toaster and my refrigerator and my automobile and even things like paper clips, like anything that has steel or iron in it, I have to pay a little bit more. But
it's not
the benefit.
Go ahead, Bill. It's not just the final consumers, although, you know, everything is eventually final consumption, but all the intermediate goods. Let's say you need a crane to take something off a ship that gets, cranes would get more expensive, and that cost has to be covered somehow. So
construction.
Yes.
It's pervasive economy-wide, and the way that people get away with these tariffs is they'll find a single industry like steel and say, well, we're helping the workers in Youngstown, Ohio, or in Pennsylvania, and it's politically popular because these are swing states and they're areas where you can get votes. But it also means that the cost of this, which far outweighs any of these concentrated benefits to this one area or this one industry, the costs are spread nationwide across 330 million people. So we're all worse off on net to maybe benefit one single industry or one single company on the margin. And those benefits turn out to actually not all be that effective based on the practice that we've seen in the last few years.
So you're saying that, first of all, these higher tariffs that are industry specific are really political hot potatoes that people fight over politically to try and get. But if they get them, it really doesn't do much because not many jobs are kept, many are lost, and then everyone pays more, including the workers who are supposed to be helped. Have I got that right?
That's basically it. It's a spiral to the bottom.
Right.
Which, the last time we tried this was 1930. It was the attempt to insulate the American economy from the Great Depression and the stock market crash. Everyone descended on Washington and said, protect our industry, we'll weather the Depression. And it turns out they're basically undermining each other. And you have this the spiral down to the bottom that destroyed world trade. And everyone's worse off.
It wasn't just the United States that was doing this in the late 20s and early 30s. You know, Hungary was protecting itself against Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia was protecting itself against Hungary, and Poland was protecting itself against all those countries and so forth. So instead of free-flowing international trade that we had in the late 19th century, we had all these locked-in economies, and they couldn't, capital flows, labor, nothing could balance the problem areas because they were all crashing everywhere.
So, but Phil, I mean, someone might say, at least we should try and get rid of this terrible trade deficit and run a trade surplus, right? And I think you are, from what you said a minute ago, you weren't too impressed with that argument either. Explain that why again.
Right. It's basically an accounting illusion. This notion that if you have a trade surplus, more goods are going out of the country than are coming in terms of imports. Well, if you're sending your goods out abroad, something has to be coming back in payment for it. I mean, this is just basic accounting. We don't just disperse goods across the world for free. And if we're not getting traded goods in return, it's other types of payments that are coming in return, and vice versa. If we're importing more than we export, yes, we're sending payment out abroad. So basically what happens is these protectionists, they focus only on the balance of trade. So goods and services across the border, they intentionally exclude all sorts of other financial instruments. And if you expand the accounting to include all of those other financial instruments,
then it's basically, balanced.
Yeah, it's by definition, it's balanced. Because if I give something, you give me something in return. It's just like any transaction. If I were to walk across the street and buy a hamburger at McDonald's, I pay them, they give me a hamburger in return. I don't have a trade deficit to McDonald's anymore.
That's a good analogy. I would want to point out that our senior fellow Ben Powell has recently published an op-ed on the subject of Trump's tariff policy. It's available on our own website, independent.org. Worth a look. I was especially struck by what Ben said about the politics of this, because Ben pointed out that it's bad economics, but apparently a successful political ploy for Trump and others who advocate higher tariffs. But it's puzzling because the only reason it could be a successful political move would be if voters hearing their claims about tariffs don't understand what tariffs have and will actually do. Doesn't that depend upon, the political success depends upon voter ignorance, am I right?
Yes, basically. Basically, you know, and I'd say this is true of a lot of policies. Politicians offer, that they promise ponies and unicorns and rainbows and wealth and abundance for everything that they're going to do. And the tariff protectionists have basically turned this into an art form. It says, we'll save this industry and we'll deliver jobs. And they may point to a couple, like a very small number of tangible jobs at this one factory that otherwise would have gone under. And they'll put that all over their advertisements and their marketing campaign. But the reality is the cost that we're paying to save that one factory is higher prices on everybody. And you have to think about it, like if you account for all those other higher prices, how many other jobs in other industries were never created simply because money was diverted into paying the expense of this bad policy?
So I do want to say one additional point, that this shouldn't all be laid on Donald Trump, even though I think everything that's been said has been accurate here. But the Biden administration has kept on the trade restrictions on China that Trump put in. So,
absolutely.
And, you know, if you look across the Trump policies, Biden has been regularly repealing this, that, and the other thing. Mostly Trump's good policies he's been repealing. And here's a counterproductive one, and he's clung to it.
That's exactly it. And they wrapped it in this national security narrative about China's the enemy, they're the economic threat. You know, here's another analogy to throw out here. When we go to war with countries, we tend to blockade those countries. And so that's the oldest economic tool in the diplomacy book. Why would we blockade ourselves from goods coming in from China or from other countries? I mean, it's like a self-defeating policy by definition.
But
well, it seems to me that politicians are almost always tempted in this direction. I mean, we mentioned Trump, you mentioned Biden. It's certainly true of the Democrats who run the state of California and the legislature and the executive there. It's always the goal to help the workers and make the economy better. Latest thing in California is a number of new laws came into force on April 1. But they weren't April Fool's jokes. One of them was the new California fast food law, which I think is a 25% raise in the fast food employee hourly rate. And so it's supposed to help the fast food workers.
Right.
But then it also had some exceptions. I mean, there was a bit of a distraction at first because it turned out that legislation here in California was going to raise the minimum wage on these fast food chains, except for ones that had in-house bakeries. And lo and behold, Panera has in-house bakeries. And lo and behold, Panera happened to be owned by a big supporter of Governor Newsom. Anyway, apparently Panera has backed out of that exception anyways. But it just leaves the basic question, will California workers be better off by raising the minimum wage in fast food by 25%?
And by the way, amazingly, the front page lead story on the Los Angeles Times was, this may backfire.
The LA Times warns that?
Yes, which is remarkable. I mean, their internal economics in the story, of course, is all scrambled. But Phil will explain the economics of this and how, as Professor Murray Rothbard used to say, minimum wage laws are compulsory unemployment laws.
Basically, yeah.
hey, yep. But if I have a job, you know, at In-N-Out Burger and my pay is going to go up by 25%, I like that, don't I, Phil?
Well, that's how it's pitched to workers. That's how it's pitched to the public to try to get them on board. We'll put in this floor of the minimum wage and people will get paid more. And it's just like magic that it's supposed to happen this way. Well, it turns out economics don't play out in the way that politicians promise. What you see in cases of a minimum wage is somebody actually has to pay for that that extra boost in pay. It doesn't just magically appear out of thin air or from the will of politicians, nor is it something that, like, you know, they're always saying greedy companies profit too much. They're going to take their profits and redivert them to the workers. Well, what always happens whenever there's a minimum wage that's put into place, it's basically a forcing of the transaction of labor at a higher price than the market has actually arrived on through just basic exchange and competition and supply and demand. So you are imposing an external constraint on the level that you can actually pay and hire people. And what always happens whenever there's a minimum wage, and this is especially true in jobs like in the service industry, so fast food's the classic example, jobs that are kind of at the margin, entry-level jobs, jobs that have lower incomes, are the first that start to feel these effects. When you raise the minimum wage, companies start to do two things. One, they'll try to pass on some of that price onto consumers as much as they can.
But they can't do it all that much because otherwise they would have raised the prices earlier.
Already. Yeah. So you'll start seeing like 25, 50 cents more for a hamburger. That'll appear on the menu. But once they've exhausted that, they have to go to other ways to make their balance sheets work. And one of those is they'll start cutting off employees. They'll start reducing the number of workers that they have for them, or they'll try to reduce the number of hours that they have, people on the payroll. So you'll start to see a decline in services. You'll get slower drive-through lines. You'll see a switch over to more automation. So these touch screens at McDonald's to order your food have started to replace the cash register. This is normal and predictable
response. Or the hamburgers are flipped by machine.
Exactly. So basically what they're doing is they are raising the cost to employ human beings. They're raising the cost to have a well-staffed kitchen and well-staffed service crew. Companies that are operating on the margin are going to adjust in other ways. And that means reducing the number of workers, reducing their hours, finding other ways to automate parts of the job. And in the end, it's those workers that are going to be the worse off because they're the ones that are losing pay. They're the ones that are going to lose their jobs first from the rise in the minimum wage.
So for the few lucky ones whose jobs don't get eliminated, they'll have a higher wage. But a bunch of others are going to lose their jobs.
That's exactly
called helping the California worker.
Right. And patting yourself on the back for being virtuous about it.
Yeah, exactly. It just seems like there's a temptation over and over again, you know, for political leaders and even for voters who are supporting them and don't quite see how this stuff works. If only, you know, you could just create some new scheme and you have some government employees somewhere who can look over and tell people what to do and what they should do and shouldn't do. If only we had, you know, more bureaucratic direction, we'd all be better off. But so rarely does it work that way. I was noticing on the subject of, you know, government power, these comments by RFK Jr., apparently now an independent rather than a Democratic presidential candidate. He's railing against big government now. Has RFK Jr. turned into a Republican? Is he trying to siphon votes from Donald Trump? What's his deal against big government? Either of you have been following this?
I've been following a little bit. I'm sure Phil has too.
Yeah,
and I'm sure you have seen it too, Grant. The man has a admirable question authority, skeptical of authority attitude. However, and it's good that there's somebody out there enunciating that. On the other hand, he is missing some good judgment. He's missing a scientific truth, solid truth, objective truth, oriented. I mean, the man believes the CIA killed his father, but really without good evidence. He believes that all vaccines are dangerous. Instead of, you know, looking carefully and seeing, well, okay, there are risks to everything, and when do the benefits outweigh the risk? He has all sorts of anti-business attitudes that are unwarranted by the science of economics. And it'd be wonderful to have a person of his stature and who's involved at the presidential level enunciating a question government, question authority attitude, but also who had a better balance of applying that to reality.
You sound like you're describing Rand Paul rather than RFK Jr.
Right, that's right. It'd be much better if we had Rand Paul elevated into the ranks of contenders. And but of course, I still appreciate that Robert Kennedy is enunciating, you know, skepticism. Be skeptical, but also do it in a wise way.
Right.
But you
right.
know, you got to give him some credit for sure that when he said the other day on CNN, apparently, he said Biden has done something that no other president in history has done, which is to order media, particularly social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Google, to censor his political opponents.
You know, Abraham Lincoln closed down the Copperhead newspapers. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, punished the black press that was skeptical. We have a new book out by one of our colleagues, David Beto, that discusses this. Black papers were sometimes questioning, you know, why should they be fighting in a war when they didn't have full civil liberties and civil rights here in the United States? Crush that, said FDR. And I could go on and on, whether it's Thomas Jefferson going after Aaron Burr, whatever it is, presidents have misused their office often, even people who were on balance good presidents.
Absolutely.
So it's not... It's excellent that he's pointing out and highlighting the bad things that Biden has done to civil liberties, and including interfering in the elections by trying to crush opponents and by politicizing the internet and the social media. But it's historically not true that this is a brand new phenomenon.
So now, Bill Everson.
Obama.
Yes.
Obama he went after the journalists.
Right.
You know,
so Bill, are you now on record as saying that on balance Biden is a good president?
I don't think that was the proper inference.
Because I don't think
he is on balance a good president.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to be clear on that point. But your point is that RFK Jr. is complaining about something that's worth complaining about,
yes,
even though it's routinely an error
about
routine.
Yeah. I think he's right to point out the gravity and extent and scope of what the Biden people are doing. And it's in some new areas.
Well, and the brazenness of it.
The brazenness.
They've been outright saying, we need to suppress quote-unquote misinformation.
Right.
Right. And, you know, it sounds like we're in Canada or some other horrible country. You laugh. This is chronically what third world countries do to suppress they put in fake news laws, they put in controls and monitoring of the social media, and that's what the Biden people are trying to do. And we have to hope, if Trump is the new president, that the temptation doesn't occur to him to do some of the same
stuff.
He
will experience the temptation.
Even though he's been a major victim of it.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Well, speaking of Biden administration efforts to restrict some liberties, what's this thing I'm hearing about a new red flag center having to do with gun ownership? Can either of you tell me what that's about?
Well, I can tell you something. So what are red flag laws? They are laws that say certain people, when they go to try to buy a gun, there's some kind of record somewhere that says this person has had a mental illness problem, or once beat up his wife, or I don't know, had a child custody issue with somebody, or it could be any number of things.
Or somebody
went to a psychiatrist once.
Right, right.
Okay.
Like not even convicted of anything previously.
No, that's right. He went to a psychiatrist once, or she did. Okay, so there are these laws. They can be loose. They're often really vaguely written. and they gather up information and they apply it to your ability to purchase a gun, have access to firearms. So what has the Biden administration done? Without a basis in congressional statute, without Congress authorizing it, he has had the Justice Department under Merrick Garland, who's already shown some bad judgment, to run this thing that scoops up and gathers together all sorts of things from attorneys and probation officers and judges and psychiatrists and social workers and whatever. They're all putting in and they're all getting out some of this information. So it's a terrible thing for both privacy and Second Amendment rights and rights to keep and bear arms.
There's no adjudication here. It's no,
right.
It's like pre-crime. It's you're assumed guilty.
It's like a horrible movie where they anticipate
dystopia.
They anticipate what you're going to do and punish you for it beforehand. That's right.
Yeah, in non-transparent ways, you don't have a way to really contest the claims made against you. There's no way to mete out whether if you really dislike someone and you file a false claim against them and say that they did all these horrible things and that gets entered into the red flag system, then suddenly their rights are intruded upon and they've never even been convicted of anything in court.
So I have to give some credit to Congressman Thomas Massey because he caught on to this. They kind of buried it. So, we've been having this fight between the president and House Republicans and the Senate Democrats over the budget and getting a spending bill passed. So once they had the spending bill, then they slipped this in to the news that they are doing this, okay? So nobody held up the spending bill to say, no, we can't spend any of this money on this. They were very careful to get all their money and then announced, oh, we're going to use some of this discretionary money that's buried in the Justice Department. So anyway, Massey has been on this, and I commend him for fighting for it. He's generally quite good on many, many things.
So the Biden administration is also trying to extend tentacles of control in an international sphere as well. I was looking at this information published recently about upcoming meeting that will be held in Geneva, Switzerland, for the World Health Organization. To set forward some new changes in international health regulations supported by President Biden, apparently, governing how pandemics are handled, giving the World Health Organization, WHO, as they call it, in American shorthand at least, new powers to make sure that if there's ever another pandemic, that the countries that are signed on to these deals will have to follow WHO guidelines with respect to lockdowns, school closures, mandates, information, disinformation restrictions. It seems like on the international level, the World Health Organization is trying to set the stage for the next pandemic so that they'll experience less resistance when these things are tried again. This is really worrying me.
Absolutely. I mean, the discussion we should be having is how do we investigate the WHO to figure out what they screwed up about COVID-19? And I'd say that they are responsible for quite a few of the missteps that we have, maybe even responsible for some of the origins of the virus in the sense that they really kind of covered up for major mistakes and attempts to hide this outbreak that occurred in China. They were politically subservient to it. The real question we should be having right now is not should we give the WHO more power, but should we even consider disbanding or major overhauls to this agency that seems to have really botched the last pandemic. They adopted a strategy that was based on unsound science, this notion of pushing lockdowns worldwide. Lockdowns had basically zero empirical effect, as we suspected at the time, and as we now know. They promoted basically these fringe coronavirus models that were premised on bad computer analytics, bad statistics, to justify this worldwide response of a very heavy-handed government, almost unprecedented in human history, and it didn't do any of the things that the WHO or the supporters of lockdowns promised they were going to do. It didn't stem the tide of the virus, but it did cause all sorts of external harms from basically shutting down the world for the better part of a year. So I'd liken it to this is akin to a town revising its fire prevention plan and going and hiring the six arsonists that are in prison to devise the thing. I mean, the WHO itself is complicit in the problems and the failures of the last pandemic. Why would we give it more power to do even more of the same in a future pandemic?
Bill, you don't understand. As the COVID inquiry in Great Britain is pointing out, the problem was not that they didn't follow the science or that they didn't allow us our civil liberties and our freedoms of movement and so forth. That wasn't the problem. The problem was that according to this COVID inquiry and according to the WHO, World Health Organization, we didn't sooner crack down on people and more extensively crack down.
We didn't lock
and
down
more
enough.
Harshly lock down and more thoroughly knocked down and locked down. And clearly that we didn't do it months, you know, a month earlier or a month and a half earlier. That is the only question.
Wow.
As far as these health bureaucrats and politicians are concerned, almost no one at a high level is actually considering the science. Now, journalists, believe it or not, admit more or less now that the school closures were completely counterproductive, that the social distancing didn't work and wasn't really based on anything. But as far as the policymakers are concerned, hey, we didn't get enough power and we didn't use whatever we had, we didn't use toughly enough.
Yeah. Well, they're the ones that have the most egg on their face because they're the ones that advocated this strategy, even countermanding their previous pandemic response documents from as recent as 2019.
That's right. That's
they did
totally
a complete
right.
reversal in embracing this lockdown strategy. And now it's kind of like the sunk cost fallacy.
Yeah.
It's they're going to plow straight ahead into it. We need this treaty to lock down even harder. You know, it's like, the Soviet Union failed because it wasn't Marxist enough. It's the same style of argument.
Right, it is. It is exactly the same style of argument. And you're exactly right that in order to cover up, in a sense, their failure on this, they're doubling down.
I would like to point out that two of our senior scholars who are affiliated with the Independent Institute, Steve Hanke and Scott Atlas, have recently published a very important research paper, extensively called COVID Lessons Learned, a Retrospective After 4 Years. It's available on our website, independent.org. If you find this piece on COVID Lessons Learned, it's a very sober and evidence-based
fair-minded
analysis.
Evidence-minded.
It's very, very fair-minded, And this is the kind of thing that actually is available, but is apparently not going to be considered at WHO's meeting next month in Geneva. Let's talk about education. And of course, we're lucky to have our education specialist, Williamson Evers, with us for the purpose.
Excuse me, but Phil is also an education specialist.
Oh, you're right.
You have different elements of education.
You both are.
We have different concentrations, but
Bill
knows plenty on this subject. All right.
Okay,
so,
good. We've got two people. So, Bill, what's the latest? I mean, you told me the other day there's a new push for bilingual education. I thought that's already been tried and rejected.
Well, there's two things that are going on. Obviously, we're getting some retrospectives on the COVID situation. I'll say something about that. And then we're having a lot of migrants pour over the United States border and scattered across the United States. Originally, you know, they were mostly in Arizona, California, and Texas, but now there are tens of thousands of them in other places. So let me first just say a little bit about the post-COVID. Obviously, we still have COVID with us, but post-serious pandemic time. So they're looking back now, and there have been a number of excellent studies showing how many years of learning were lost and how difficult it is, you know, to catch the kids up. And I think the fair answer is certainly for the public school kids, the majority of them that were hurt by this, they're never going to catch up. So this is going to be a foregone opportunities for these kids. They'll never catch up. They'll have deficiencies going into college.
That's
college
tragic.
Kids will have deficiencies in their later workforce life. There'll be gaps that they should have had, at least familiarity with these topics that they never really got, because for most kids, the online learning didn't work. for 10, 15%, A, it was a blessing. They could move at their own speed. They were savvy at this, and it was just a wonderful thing. But for the rest of the kids, it was a tragedy. They couldn't focus well. They couldn't get good feedback from their teachers. It wasn't the moral theater of the classroom where they were rivalrous with their other students and trying to please the teacher and so forth. So all the advantages of the brick and mortar schools were just lost for this several years. And one of the things that's been lost is attendance. So it's hard to learn something in a school setting if you're not there. And, right. You know, we as lovers of freedom are not really in favor of people going out chasing young kids around and whatever, but it's still nonetheless true that if you don't develop the habit of going to school and you don't, and your parents don't support that, you're not going to be learning things because you can't, or you'll, you know, if you're in the middle of learning geometry or algebra one or something like that, and you're missing a block of time, how do you, you know, these subjects are often architectonic. They're continual. They go step by step. In science, if you skip Avogadro's number, well, man, what are you going to do? You just don't know what's going on. So the problem is that this is now chronic, large-scale absenteeism developed out of the habit being broken. So we not only know that it was very harsh on children, particularly children from lower-income, less-educated families, but it has broken this habit of attending and focusing on school and learning. So then let's switch to the immigration issue. So we have all these children coming in. Of course, it's going to bollocks up the data because, you know, we'd like to see kids gaining, you know, the cohorts of kids improving over time. Well, we're bringing in a lot of children, some of whom who missed a year of schooling getting to the United States, okay, but they also come in also, many of them, certainly not all, some are quite well-educated. But many of them are not well-educated. And then they're coming in with a new language, so the school system has to adjust to that. So we're going to see probably not just plateaus in data as to where the children are in the United States, but we're going to see decline. And we're already seeing some indications of that. Now, of course, these school districts are now in a panic. They have Somalis, they have Haitians, they have Guatemalans, they have all kinds of Chinese, Vietnamese, they have all kinds of people coming in. And they've lost something that we learned 20 years ago. And that was that a thing called transitional bilingual education, which means you teach the kid in his home language up until about the seventh grade, and then you begin to phase in English. Okay, this is what's generally thought of as bilingual education. Doesn't work. It's a permanent poverty trap. They never become truly fluent in English. It's just a disaster. Okay, so
you limit their exposure to English at the time when they're young, right, and most able to absorb,
right,
it.
When they're most receptive.
Now there's another meaning of bilingual education, which is called double intensive bilingual education or double deep immersion bilingual education. Now, those are a number of names, but it means that you have stuff fully in Spanish some of the time and fully in English some of the time because, you know, people from non-Spanish speaking families are learning Spanish and Spanish speaking family kids are learning English, but you're progressing from the beginning, from kindergarten or nursery school, preschool, you're progressing fully in these languages.
That sounds
better.
That
works pretty well under good teachers. But if you can't afford that, because that's quite expensive, the thing to do is have a ramp up in the teaching English for the non-English speaking kids, and then put them in deep immersion English. okay, if you're not going to have double deep immersion, you give them some prep and some special attention, and then you put them in deep immersion in English. That's what works. The school districts, and this is Los Angeles, this is Chicago, this is all over the country, they've forgotten, if they ever really learned it, that this was a failure, and they're going to do it again. And if they do it, it's going to be a failure again. And too bad for the children.
Yeah, that's a shame. Wow. That's amazing. Immersion really works. I mean, I know from my own experience, although later in life, I was living in Geneva, Switzerland for a year studying, and, you know, it was complete immersion almost. My French got way better than it ever would have been out of necessity. And children are even more adaptable.
Children, especially up until they're 9 years old.
Oh, yeah.
They are deep sponges of this. And that's partly why the wait till seventh grade thing is crazy. You have to catch them while they're young. Okay? And also, if they're going to learn, I mean, there are a few people that can pick up accentless English later on in life. But most people are like Henry Kissinger. Okay? Does he still sound like a German trying to speak English?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you know.
He does fine, but...
But the point is, you can pick it up accentless at a young age.
Yes, you can. Yeah. I want to come back to just a point you made at the beginning of this conversation about education and habits of attendance and so forth, Bill. You pointed out that, you know, we want to preserve people's freedom and so forth.
Right.
But I think, you know, the underlying fact here is that adults deserve full-fledged liberty.
Right.
But children... in their formative stages, and all of us have gone through that because we're human,
we need
to be in situations, school and home
otherwise. We need guidance.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's right.
Where good habits can be formed.
That's right.
And during that habit-forming phase is not the time for full-fledged universal liberty. It's the time for children to be formed by their parents and schools and communities.
Right. So Aristotle and many other philosophers have pointed out, including a few German ones, that virtue is a habit. Virtue is a self-discipline into following certain courses of action on a regular basis. And also, children are living as, you know, they're not only in the custody of their parents, but they're living as guests in their parents' premises. And so if the parents, as I think they generally do, want their kids to be educated so they can succeed in life, the kids should be going along with that and not way to school, skipping off with some other kids to do some non-school thing. So, on the other hand, there are truancy things that are...
Oh, yeah, they can be really
way
draconian.
Out of hand.
Yeah,
and,
I agree.
You know, jailing parents because a kid didn't go to school.
It's terrible,
many excesses in life that we want to avoid. So
yeah, absolutely.
So that's right. An adult has greater freedom.
It is amazing, though, thinking about the other issues, and you both have commented on this now and previously, that the fallout from the pandemic policies is amazingly extensive and extending over time. So, you know, these families affected by the loss of education, for example, they're going to be affected for a couple of generations. It's really tragic. People who have lower education will have lower incomes, which means they won't have as good health care, which means they won't have as good health. So in the name of health, we've actually harmed health.
Over the long term,
We
basically spent 2 years encouraging this habit.
Right.
Well, don't go to school. Maybe if you log in on Zoom and you get a couple of minutes of lesson a day because your schools are closed. So it was an active policy decision to keep students out of the schools. And you know, we can go back to historical examples and look at other areas when education has suddenly halted.
Right. We know about this. Teachers strike.
Exactly.
Prolonged teachers strike. We know about other things where there's been an interruption, as Phil's saying, and we know there's a learning loss. And the amazing thing in this case is that the teachers' unions pushed for extended lockdowns and close offs of education. And now it's coming back to bite them because they're going to have lowered attendance. And the money that goes to schools depends on attendance.
Right, right.
And so they did it to themselves as well as to the student.
But absolutely.
But still, let me just put this question back at you. This is sort of devil's advocate. But I mean, couldn't somebody say, well, early in the pandemic, years, nobody really knew what was going on. So we had to be utterly draconian. No one knew anything about this stuff. Right, Phil?
Well, there was great uncertainty early in the pandemic, but we also had previous experiences and previous plans in place. It wasn't like suddenly a virus appeared out of nowhere and we had never encountered this before in human history. We had a century of scientific research and epidemiology that said these tactics do not work. Locking society down does not work. They tried it in the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918.
Right. Airborne virus.
Yeah. Very similar characteristics in the sense that it's an easily caught airborne virus. And you can go back and look at the data. Cities that tried quarantines or mass lockdowns, or I think the most draconian example is they looked at military bases, because this is in the middle of World War I. And they found out that military bases that locked everyone in the barracks did no better than the military bases that were wide open.
Wow. Right.
So there's no difference between the two. We know that this policy
eventually
just does
not virus do. Gets through.
Exactly. So we went kind of back to this old medieval strategy of superstition that if we lock everybody down because there was high uncertainty, and it was also premised on these models, these epidemiology models, that they were like hard-coded in to find the result that they wanted, which was lockdowns. So it's like if I pre-program the model to say that lockdowns will save lives, I shouldn't be shocked that that's the result the model gives me. But then if you compare it to reality and it's not performing, it's time to discard that model. And we never did that.
Exactly. Although it could have done. I mean, early on, you and
Absolutely.
Some of your colleagues in epidemiology and so forth talked about these issues and pointed out that focused sequestering, focused quarantine for most vulnerable groups would have been appropriate.
Absolutely.
But of course, eventually, old people in nursing homes die eventually. They're not in nursing homes for no reason. I would also just point out that really, even though we had supposedly unknown things January to March or something like that, by that time, we were realizing that some places were not locking down and were doing fine.
Yeah,
and
the
so
Sweden
everything,
example.
Everything that happened after, say, I give them a little leeway, January through March. After that, it was asinine what they kept doing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah, 2 weeks to flatten the curve.
Power mad and asinine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think, one of the lessons learned to me in very simple terms is that there's something to be said for the basic outlook that when in doubt, don't turn to more government power.
Right.
Whereas the opposite point of view seems to be discredited over and over again, which is if there's any possible excuse for more government control, go for it. That's proved ill pretty much over and over again. So we're going to wind
this
down.
Never let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah, that. So we're going to wind this down. I'd like to give each of you opportunity to make one last comment on any subject you think is worthwhile. Phil, I'll probably start with you in a minute. You probably have some final thoughts you'd like to share with our friends.
Yeah, I think summarizing several of the themes of this episode is don't look to the failed policies of the past as a solution to things in the present. We see this in the tariff case with Trump. We see this in the WHO going back to basically, frankly, medieval styles of approaching epidemiology, even in the wake of probably the most catastrophic public health policy failure in many generations with what they did in COVID-19. It's like keep going back to the past and repeating the same mistakes and expecting a different result. It doesn't work that way. In fact, if anything, it just shows that you're gravitating toward reasons that are outside of scientific evidence, outside of a sound policy basis.
Yeah, good point, Bill.
In my one last thing, I'd like to introduce a new topic which struck me, and that is headscarf. So France is going through one of its periodic frenzies over laicization. So they have this sort of the idea is that the state should almost be equally anti-religious. So it should be anti-Christian, it should be anti-Muslim, it should be anti-Jewish, instead of kind of neutral and free toward all of religion. And so one of their rules is that you can't have any detectable overt religious symbolism in your clothing or decoration when you're in school. And so you can't wear a cross that's visible. I mean, you might hide it under your clothing. You can't wear some kind of Jewish headgear of some sort. And of course, you can't have a Muslim headscarf, okay, which is really a later, it's not like modesty is prescribed in the Quran, but not the details of both. But anyway, I'm not trying to make some point about Muslim theology here. I'm just saying that the Muslim families wear these headscarves or a lap. So anyway, this girl was leaving school and she puts on a hat and then she puts on her headscarf and she hasn't like walked 50 yards from the school yet. And the principal of the school says, take that off. And she alleges that he shoved her. And he says no. And I guess maybe the balance of the evidence is maybe he didn't shove her. But anyway, he was adamant about that she couldn't be, she was on the, you know, just leaving school. And it was, she still had to be completely uncovered. So anyway, all the political parties in France, the socialists, the center left, the moderate center right, the ultra-nationalist right, they're all saying, oh, this is so terrible, headscarves are so dangerous to society, it's an attack on the state to wear a headscarf, and on. I mean, we Americans, we look at this and we say, this is kind of peculiar that you guys are just so hopped up about headscarves. Now, I mean, they do have problems, you know, kind of assimilating to some extent their Muslim populations. Some of this has to do with colonial history, but some of it just has to do with, I think,
regulation.
The Turks had a similar problem. They had a extremely anti-clerical beginning in the 1920s of the Turkish Republic. And again, no headscarves anywhere. And they carried it way too far. I think the society can have religious liberty and not have theocratic imposition on itself and still allow women and girls to wear headscarves. Anyway, it's interesting to see France, who all of this time makes fun of the United States, just turning itself into in knots and going crazy over them. That's my final thought.
Okay, needless knots. Thank you very much, Bill Evers. I appreciate both of you joining in on Independent Outlook today. Williamson Evers, Philip Magnus. I remind our friends far and wide, you can find a lot of interesting resources on these and other topics at our website, independent.org. And I hope you'll all join us again on the next episode of Independent Outlook. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.